Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next 2 hours. Got a great show planned for you tonight on this November the 20th, and already on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone now, it's November the 21st, the early morning hours. Lots of things going on this week. In terms of the political scene, changes in government, some very, very controversial choices taking place with our president-elect and his cabinet choices. He's already come under fire for a few of these choices, and it appears that that's not going to back off within the next couple of weeks. There are at least 12, and I'm told it may be as many as 17 lawsuits across the nation which have been filed to force Barack Obama to begin producing documentation verifying that he was born in the United States and that he is eligible to run as the president. Not because he thinks he is, but because it conforms to the Constitution. And the situation in Hawaii as of the last couple of days is rather nebulous. It was on the 18th when we had Roxy Hampton and Dr. Len Horowitz on. Roxy is actually in Hawaii and has access to information that we may not even get here. And she hadn't really heard anything other than that Andy Martin had been at a memorial service for Barack Obama's grandmother over a week beyond her passing. Actually, 2 weeks beyond her passing. Quite unusual how things work out for these privileged people, especially the privileged non-Americans. So give us something to think about and watch in the coming days. I've got another article coming out in next month's early edition of the Idaho Observer where we're going to beat these court deadlines so that this information gets out into the public domain. The information about the CIA relationship between Stanley Armour Dunham, Madeline Lee Payne Dunham, and Stanley Ann Dunham, particularly their life in Oklahoma City and their working at Tinker Air Force Base as foreign agents. Very interesting information coming out. Also, picture documentation. And I'll leave the off the mainstream news for the next show and take a moment now and introduce tonight's guest. He's becoming quite a good friend. I've got tremendous respect for this gentleman for the amount of legal work that he's doing and the reasons he's doing this. We're going to be discussing tonight his system, his creative ideas for empowering the American people, and giving us the ability to earn a living by performing tasks and in the area where we're living. Many of us have multiple skills that can actually feed the family, put food on the table, maybe even send your kids to school. And we've got some ideas along that area, too. And if you haven't heard of Hopeless Indiana, you will tonight. And it bears repeating, those of you who have heard this before, listen in again, because once this sinks in, you're going to see that there's an opportunity for us to step outside the box, to extricate ourselves from the matrix, and create a new reality for ourselves. we have that right, and we are exercising it in real time. And we're going to talk about that tonight with tonight's guest. He also has over 100 websites. Two of the more important ones are his MyClads website as well as lawmall.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome back again to Evident Footprints my good friend, attorney Carl Pearson. Carl, welcome to the show.
Much. You know, I'd like to lead off just for a second just to say that, every person in a town or village can create prosperity for that town or village. Everyone has that power, if they keep listening.
And we don't have to depend on Barack Obama to do that for us, is what you're saying.
We can't depend on the government. The federal government isn't really going to do what we can do for ourselves locally, and that's really the thrust of what I would like to be able to talk about, is how an individual in a town can bring in prosperity no matter what the town is, anywhere in the country.
Okay. Well, before we dive into that, you got to hear me open up with the current news. Of course, this isn't letting up, and you know, the media is calling him President Obama already, acting as though he is the president. You know, the delegates have not really made their choice yet. That vote hasn't taken place, and there are these lawsuit issues that are going to have to be addressed. Do you really think they can just ignore every one of these lawsuits?
No, absolutely not. A lawsuit is actually a way of getting attention and requiring a decision in contradistinction to a political complaint in which generally nothing ever happens. If a person politically complains about something, they can't expect to get an answer. They can expect generally to be ignored. But if you bring that complaint into court, and if it is justiciable, you actually can you do require someone in government to answer you, and that someone is a judge, and you could get a favorable decision, or you might get thrown out.
Well, with the number of cases that are being heard, why do you think the media is still downplaying this? Are they hoping it goes away, or...
Well, the media doesn't generally talk about those things that are valuable to the people. They have an unwritten law, at least the main media, of trying to screen out anything that's useful and diversionary from trying to get people to understand nothing. The goal is to have us be dumbed down and not to know what's going on, so that if something is useful, they certainly don't publicize it.
Yeah, I'm wondering if Britney Spears was suing Barack Obama or Paris Hilton. Would they be paying attention to it then?
Yeah. As long as there's no seriousness of purpose, they would absolutely be given quite a lot of attention. But if they do something worthwhile, then you don't expect anything to be publicized.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way it works. You know, you have to figure it out that that's the way it works. The head of AP told me, Carl, what are you coming in here and bothering us for? You know we can't print that.
Hmm. And how long ago was that?
About 3 or 4 years ago.
Well, I think 30 or 40 years ago it was the same situation. You know, we look at... No, we're coming up, in fact, tomorrow is the anniversary of the JFK assassination, 1963, November 22nd, 1963, that's tomorrow.
And what a difference between now and then, because now generally everyone understands what happened, and they a lot of us think we know what happened, and back then there was less certainty, more uncertainty caused by the press, but actually most people now are able to figure out what happened.
Yeah. One interesting detail, not that we have to go into too much depth on this topic, one individual who could not remember where he was, and I find this absolutely ridiculous, is George H.W. Bush. Of course, he claimed that he called in from Houston to Dallas to warn of an individual that belonged to the student student union version of the Young Republicans in Texas, and he was likely the person that was going to assassinate President Kennedy. And then when asked where he was, Bush couldn't remember where he was. Do you think over all this time now, as we have figured out what has really happened there, do you think Bush really remembers now where he was on that day?
Well, it's very hard to... I'm trying to think of myself. I knew where I was on that day. I was in the New York Stock Exchange building. When I heard that Kennedy had been killed, I ran into the stock exchange for the first and only time in my life to see what pandemonium was taking place, because I just happened to be working in that building. And there was pandemonium, and that's how I know where I was on that day. I'm sure most people can remember.
Yeah, I was in French class that day, and I was sitting about 3 feet from the classroom door. And I remember what direction I was facing and everything. Now, I've seen pictures of George H.W. Bush standing in front of the Texas School Book Depository. I thought maybe that picture might refresh his memory.
When was he there?
That day.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. That picture's been online for a couple of years. I should probably post it to my website, but I should share with you, I'm writing a book, actually, now. I'm going to be expanding on some of the research that I've done on this series of articles on these presidents and presidential candidates. And I'm going to tie it into some of the really salient topics that I covered, like the Federal Reserve and Nikola Tesla, and how all this ties in with what we're experiencing today.
But let me give you something for your book, because on the day that Jack Kennedy was killed, I had a meeting scheduled with Richard M. Nixon, because I worked in his law firm in the Stock Exchange building.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a meeting set for 4:30. His secretary, the one with the tape problem. Remember the one with the
18-minute gap in the tape?
Right, right. She had made an appointment with me so I could visit and meet with the president. And not that he wasn't the president, the Richard Nixon, at 4:30, because that was my last day at the law firm. And I wanted to meet with him and volunteer to help out and do this and that. So at noontime or so, and where he was, he was at Houston. No, I'm sorry. He went to Dallas. He was in Dallas that day. He had gone there to meet with the oil interests in Dallas. He was, which were our client. He was there meeting with oil interests in Dallas, and I knew that, and I was waiting for him to return.
Are you speaking of Clint Murchison?
I don't know. I'm not sure who the people were that he was meeting with.
Okay.
But who knows who it might have been. But he was in Dallas on the day. But I will also say that he also was out of the airport, and he had returned, and the reporters saw him go through the airport, what was called Idlewild at the time, mm-hmm. JFK International now. And when they saw him go through the airport, nothing had transpired in Dallas up to that point. So he went through the airport without any real attention. But when the reporters heard what happened in Dallas, they then intercepted his motorcade back to New York, and they detoured him from coming to his meeting with me, and they took him to a major hotel where he gave a press conference about what happened. So I was sort of involved in that day. I remember it quite well.
Now, my understanding was he was at a party the night before, which was attended by J. Edgar Hoover, And I think George DeMorenschild was there. DeMorenschild, after that party, fled to somewhere in Central America for a short time. He had to disappear.
Were any oil interests there? I'm sure.
Oh,
there
yes.
Were.
Clint Murchison. I think this party was at Murchison's place. Oh, definitely.
Isn't that funny how these different stories tie together?
Mm-hmm. And there's another individual, and I'm trying to remember his last name. He went by the first name Red. And I can't remember if it's Parker. I may have misspoken already. I should be certain of the name, but tomorrow there'll be a Red Parker coming after me. But this individual is actually running some aspect of the business school, the business college at University of Texas right now. And I think this started like around that time, or just after the Kennedy assassination. You know, it'd be worth looking that up. But I know that George DeMorenschild was responsible for bringing Lee Harvey Oswald to the United States and making the arrangements between the two Connecticut senators of the day. And was it John Stafford? Was that one of the senators? And the other was Prescott Bush.
There was a Stafford bill. There was a bill for loans named Stafford.
I think it was Stafford was the name. But I know that the two Connecticut senators signed a visa to allow Oswald to come into the United States. And of course, this was a plot that, I mean, it stinks right there when you hear Bush was involved, you know, because he was involved several attempted overthrows of the government going back to the 1930s. There was one in 1933. There was the Union Banking Corporation scandal that they claim they only discovered in 41, and they didn't shut the bank down until 42. But that was an attempt to overthrow the government.
What about the Reagan attempted assassination? You're familiar with that story. I mean, everyone has heard that.
Yes, I've written about that to some extent, yes.
The attempted assassin had a meeting that evening. It was going to have a dinner meeting with the son of the president, Vice President Bush.
Well, John Hinckley Jr., who was the assassin, to me seemed like he was a monarch product of the MK Ultra mind control program. He was the son of John Hinckley Sr., who was a former oil company partner of George Bush's.
Jesus.
And that night, Hinckley's other son, I forget his first name, and his wife were to have dinner in Denver with Neil Bush and his wife. I just find it highly, highly ironic that that should happen at the same time.
Unbelievable.
That those relationships, that three people in that family have something to do with George H.W. Bush on the same day. In different parts of the country. So that's known that Hinckley Sr. was a Bush partner and in the oil business, and that there must have been some connection. Now, what's amazing to me is every one of Bush's sons failed at business. George W. Had to be bailed out of his oil travesties in Texas. And that's where Bin Laden comes in, that family. And then Neil Bush and the Silverado Savings. It's amazing that these guys get away with all this thievery like this. It's just one incident after the other. You had the Zapata oil and the Bay of Pigs scandal going on. Bush was behind that. Countless indictments of Cheney,
an indictment of Cheney and Gonzalez. Have you looked into that?
Oh, I heard about that. I didn't have time to read up on it today, but somebody sent me something today that directed my attention right to that.
It was a state indictment for some kind of interference or attempt to make pressure somebody with respect to a government contract. I'm not sure exactly what it was.
Mm-hmm.
But the judge was going to review the indictment. The indictment was made by a grand jury, and then it goes to a judge, and he has to decide what to do with it.
Well, there's plenty of reasons to indict these guys for lots of things, pretty much everything they've done.
Well, and sometimes when these people are the law, that the indictments don't take place.
Yeah. That's very evident, too. Well, we could go on and on and on with this stuff, but I appreciate you sharing that information. That sort of confirms what I know about the Kennedy assassination. And I could probably write a whole book on what I've learned about George de Morenchil. You know, here's another suicide, shotgun to the mouth. And he was not a very large man. In fact, the shotgun that he shot himself with would have been impossible for him to pull the trigger and put the barrel in his mouth. His arms were too short. But somehow they pull it off when they really want to commit suicide. They're able to do it.
Yeah.
I guess I'm implying that if somebody really wants them to commit suicide, they can help them.
Oh, absolutely.
So, moving on to brighter topics, we are in a space, our consciousness and the reality of an imploding economy. They're bailing out, or it's probably a foregone conclusion that they're going to bail out the three U.S. automakers, Ford, GM, and what's the third one? Chrysler.
Yes.
And that somehow all of these failing companies are entitled to billions of dollars. I just can't make sense out of it.
There's another way they could do it. And that is, they could put the companies into bankruptcy and scale back their costs so that they could actually survive without government money. And the only thing I've heard as an argument against that, and that would be the normal thing to do, if you have too much of an expense, you scale it back by filing for bankruptcy, which permits you to unload unfavorable contracts, to rewrite them. And that would be the way of handling it. The only thing I've heard against that as an argument is that people might not want to buy a car from a company that is in bankruptcy. But would they want to buy a car from somebody that needs to take $25 billion from the government and maybe going back for more? I mean, I don't know if that makes any difference.
Well, I think... I think we should be able to acquire a list from all the congressmen and the senators that are driving their own vehicles, say to the Rayburn office building or wherever they park there on Capitol Hill, and we should do a comparison, see what cars they drive and how much money they're giving the manufacturers of those cars. I think it would be very interesting to see if they even drive American cars.
Check to see how they got the car, who gave them the car or the right to use it.
And yes.
In other words, follow the money and see how they got that privilege. Did you see that all GM managers, all, what is it, 4,000 of them, are able to have two brand new cars a year? They had four a year up until a year or so ago, and now they have two brand new cars a year. Every 6 months they change cars at no cost, about $250 a month for them. So.
And you're saying there's 4,000 of them?
Yeah.
So that's 8,000 cars a year.
Yeah, yeah. Unbelievable.
Do they drive the people, the executives from AIG to California with those cars?
The theory they say is to let the managers become familiar with the problems of the car, like whether the ashtray works well or not, and then they file reports. All 4,000 people file reports, and that justifies their use of the car. But I'll bet you that no one ever looks at the reports.
Mm-hmm. I guess, and they have to file a report to see how well the car drives to a massage parlor.
Exactly.
Right, or to the hairdresser, you know.
You know, I've got another observation that's relating to this, and that is that with respect to the bailout and the banks, we and the financial institutions, we've been so focused by the press on whether a president is entitled to take $100 million or $50 million from the company, but that isn't the real issue, because if the president doesn't take that money, it goes to the company anyway. I think what we ought to do is condition any bailout to the removal of things that are anti-consumer, such as high default rate of interest or late fee charges. That should be the condition, that the banks not be allowed to rip off consumers and yet take the consumers' money. It should be a two-way street, at least.
Well, I think if we have to pay, I don't know what the amount is, but just imagine, so far I've heard different figures from people, anywhere from $16,000 a person to a quarter of $1 million a person in the workforce who's going to be paying for the first bailout. And they're adding another $25 billion to this just to kick it off. Get it jump started. And if you went with the low figure on the $16,000, allow us $16,000 of a down payment on any vehicle of our choice.
That'd be good. Right?
Why not? I mean, if we're paying to bail them out, then that should go towards a down payment. Now, if the car we're buying is only $10,000, then kick us back $6,000 or $7,000.
Call it a rebate. You love to give rebates.
Yeah. Exactly. Why doesn't that occur? I mean, what's their point in staying in business?
Well, here's an issue that they don't like to talk about that much, and that is, if you went into bankruptcy, there would be a scaling back of the hourly rate of the employees. And in New York City, we have the same problem. New York State, the politicians do not want to reduce the rate of pay of the city and state workers. And yet, the rest of us who don't work for the New York City or New York State are suffering a decline. I don't see why a decline shouldn't be required of city and state workers.
Mm-hmm. Well, it should be. I think it should. If it should be all the way across the board. No.
Yeah.
Well, it's obvious that somewhere someone is not paying enough attention to this, Carl. And so they figure they can just flaunt it in front of us, and if we make a big deal about it, they've got judges that'll slow it down, stymie it, whatever way they can, and maybe it'll go away, or people will run out of money, or it'll be too late to change it. I don't know exactly the point. I haven't put my finger on the exact date that somebody just decided to hell with the courts, to hell with the laws, to hell with everything. Let's just do what we want and deal with the issues as they come up. I mean, this is literally like that's what's going on, and there's no alternative. There's no possibility except to just realize that this system has all of a sudden become totally corrupt. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, I think that that I feel that we have to give up trying to reform or expecting any reform at the top, at the federal level. I don't see it happening, regardless of the election outcomes and everything else. Uh-huh. I don't see any reform that we can count on that will be that meaningful. I see it's getting worse and worse, and it doesn't matter who's in there. It just gets worse. It isn't really the fault of any one person. It's just that the system itself has been taken over by people who refuse to allow it to change so that it keeps the same people in power for a long mm-hmm. period of time. They get paid off by vested interest not to do the right thing. And I think that if we sort of just disregard that and work at the local level where we do have some input, we can actually knock on every door in a small community and get people to learn what's really happening and to be able to help them help themselves. We can do that in a small community like Hopeless, Indiana. Mm-hmm. But you can't do that nationally. It costs too much money to try to every day pay for advertising and try to get your message through. You can't do it. It just costs too much. And the main media probably wouldn't even sell you advertising if you had the money.
Yeah. Well, what you're suggesting now, and we've talked about this on other shows, but for the new listeners out there, you're suggesting a self-empowerment or a mutual empowerment of the little guy on the local level. That's what we've been talking about on this show for the past 2 weeks now, is a more powerful message dealing with the principles of individuality and responsibility and awareness and attention and communication and all of those little issues that we sort of take for granted. And your what you're doing, Carl, fits right in there perfectly, because your approach has been to empower the individual, and then because you're empowering the individual, you're automatically going to be empowering the local town, his friends, his family, the people he does business with are all going to be affected by that on the local level, which is really where everyone is most of the time.
Exactly.
You know, we have New York rammed down our no offense, because you're in New York, but the people in Hopeless, Indiana care less what's going on in New York, really. And I don't mean that in a degrading way. I think you understand what I'm saying. Their problems are there in Hopeless, Indiana. Their kids are in school in Hopeless, Indiana. They shop there. They're paying their bills there. And they probably would like to be able to go to New York, but can't afford to go. Can't afford a lot of things right where they are in Hopeless, Indiana. And the ideas that you have come up with are going to change that reality. And you and I both know that that's already underway, that's happening.
When it comes to thinking about, when you live in, let's say, Hopeless, Indiana, and you think, oh my God, I really wish I could be doing something in Washington, D.C. or in New York and really try to change things, it's really funny and that they don't realize that the change that they can effect is right in their own home yard. They can do it right there. one person can bring in a free college for the whole area. A tuition-free college can be brought in by one person, maybe your listener, in any town or village, not just Hopeless, Indiana, but any place. An individual has the ability to start the thing going in a local area, in their hometown or village, small city, and make the change that never will come from the federal government.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are people out there thinking, well, why would they want to do it in my town? We have, and you know, such and such a school there already, or we have two or three schools there. Well, the first rhetorical question to ask would be, how many people from your community are attending those schools? How many are not attending because they can't afford it, or because the means has not been put into place to enable them to go to school there?
And how many are forced to pay money they don't have and to borrow money they'll never pay back, and to devote themselves to a life of penal servitude trying to pay off excessive loans? I mean, mm-hmm. there's too much money that we now have to pay to go to a regular college, and the expectations of what you can earn after leaving aren't even enough after taxes to pay off the loan. So really, I wrote a book in which I advise people, really, the time has come to seriously consider whether you should go to college at all, if you have to pay the price that many colleges charge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say more and more students are coming to the realization that they have some local schools on a community college level that have enabled them to get an education, but they haven't been able to land that job, that dream job that they were promised, and it was drilled into them while they were growing up and in high school. You got to go to college. You're going to get a good job if you go to college. If you don't get a college education, you'll never amount to anything. You won't be able to work. And yet, how many times do we hear stories about this guy dropped out of school. He flunked out of college, and now he's a billionaire. So it isn't always a question of what are they going to teach you. It's more that they want their hands on that money. And your reward is that certificate. And your reward is that you're going to be paying for 20 or 30 or maybe the rest of your life. You're going to be paying off your college tuition, your college loans. And where did all that money really go? How much of it actually was related to the specific education that you received? And you're offering, or you're sharing with the listening audience, that there's a way to create a school for nothing, virtually nothing, in comparison to the types of loans that students are forced to take if they want to attend that school.
Here's the way it's done, and that is that any town or village or city can have its own tuition-free college, a four-year college, where you actually study in a school, not by online or telephone or email, but it's actually a school where people gather together and they have a teacher, a blackboard chairs, and they learn that way.
Mm-hmm.
And this can be done with no tuition. You don't have to have tuition at all. Of course, the teachers have to be paid, but if you have a school that's stripped down, and if you eliminate the elements of the school or of the college that make it expensive, you can actually bring the cost of schooling per year, per student, down to less than $2,000. That's only a package of cigarettes a day per student. It's not really that much money. And you can raise that $2,000 a year. So raising it is really not the issue, whether you have the student pay $2,000 a year or whether you can raise the money by certain techniques in the town and not have to charge at all is not really the issue. The issue is, can you have a low-priced college in the town? What do you do? And how is it that you can have a college where you can have no tuition or almost no tuition? And the way it's done is by having it as an equivalency college, meaning a college that does not give a degree, but goes through all of the same things that a college does and gives you an equivalency certificate once you pass the same tests and where otherwise you would have been entitled to a degree, you get an equivalency certificate. So by eliminating the degree, you start on the way towards eliminating a massive amount of costs associated with higher education that have now driven the cost of a college education up to maybe $30,000 to $70,000 a year per student in many colleges. $30,000 to $70,000 a year. Now, those are expenses that you can avoid. You only need to spend $2,000 a year. But if you're going to attend a distant college and you have dormitory and all that, you're going to pay, say, $40,000 or $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year. You don't have to. So we need to strip out accreditation. No degree, no accreditation, no student loans, no campus, no library, no food service, no dormitory, no groundskeepers. And when you start taking all those things out, you're down to $2,000 a year.
Well, you know, if I draw an analogy between, and just make a comparison between a college loan, let's say it was one of the schools that charges $60,000 to $70,000 a year in tuition.
Tuition isn't that high, but it's the other expenses. It's the living in college and... overall expenses, like $35,000 is a frequent tuition.
Yeah. Well, we have a college in our area that runs, you know, on the average $40,000 a year.
Yeah.
Now, if you go to a four-year school, that's $160,000. Translated into a home loan, that's a $480,000 home, a $500,000 home. Wouldn't it make sense to get a home loan? Homeschooled?
Yeah, but buy a home instead of going to college. Become a millionaire instead of becoming a college graduate.
Yeah, exactly. The whole reason I'm bringing that up, I think you get my point, is that that the person that gets that home loan, which is going to work out over a 30-year period, I don't know what the student loans are, whether they're 10 years or 15 or 20 years, but certainly most of the recipients of those school loans, regardless of how much is for the tuition and room and board and the various expenses, books and all of that, what they have to go through after they graduate, after they get their degree, the type of job that they have to take or the number of jobs they have to take to be able to make those loan payments is staggering. And so the very workforce that they think they're going to be working in is not welcoming them because it can't pay them what they would make, so they're forced to take two or three jobs if their intention is to keep up those loan payments, right?
That's right. So if you have a tuition-free school or one that costs a package of cigarettes a day, you wind up not needing loans and not having to pay off loans once you complete the college. Mm-hmm. And you then can get a job where the employer is going to have your services and your full attention because you're not going to be looking for other jobs or pestering them all the time for a raise because you're broke. And you would be unhappy as an employee if you're not earning enough to pay off your indebtedness.
Yeah.
So instead of having unhappy employees, the local employers in the area that has a free college would find that the students that graduate don't owe that money, and they become full-time employees, happy employees, and more dedicated employees.
Yeah, of course. Now, isn't it interesting also that, and this was after I said, buy a house, that's exactly what the bailout was for, to bail out the so-called, and I say so-called because the issue is the banks are corrupt. It's not so much the people with the mortgages, but it's the very nature of the mortgages and then the derivatives and the hedge funds that they created out of the value of those securities agreements, those instruments that were created as a result of those mortgage loans being handed out. They mentioned also bailing out credit card companies and bailing out the student home loan program. Student school program. So they were lumping the home loans and the school loans all together in one lump sum, along with credit cards, which are run up by the people on both both of those market groups. Anyway, is it any surprise? So there have to be a lot of people outside of the school that are making money off of those school loans, wouldn't you say, Carl?
Yeah, well, yeah. What happens is this with a student loan. A college will absorb any kind of money that any student can ever borrow on a student loan. And many schools, trade schools, will set their tuition in an amount equal to the amount of a student loan that a student can get, without regard to the real cost of the education. You just price a trade school program according to whatever money the student has available. The student gets a check and they turn it over to the school, and it pays for the tuition. The student doesn't realize that when they get out of school and have to start paying off a loan, they're not going to make enough money to service that loan, to pay the interest and pay off the loan. So many of the loans go into default. But when those loans were packaged originally and sold to investors, there was an assumption, probably, of a higher payoff rate. And when the students started in default, it meant that the people who bought those loans, all those investors, now are holding paper that's worth a lot less than they paid for it. But the people who sold the paper took the money, put it in their bank account, and bought stocks with it, or did something with it, bought real estate. So the money has gone into the hands of the people that created those packages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand that. And that is part of the source of the problem, and the other part is what they're not telling us at all.
When the school gets the money, who do you think gets that money? When the student loan basically goes to a university,
well,
the
professors are
right.
going to get it, and the infrastructure that keeps that school open.
The president is drawing $1.5 million a year, which isn't really that outrageous compared to the amounts received by financial institution presidents. But,
yeah.
but you know, $1.5 million is about the top salary of a university president, so that doesn't disturb me one iota. It's not that bad. But, you know, maybe it should only be $700,000, but who cares? What happens is that you have, at Harvard Law School, where I went to school, I'm making the assumption that a Harvard Law professor gets $200,000 a year. I don't think that that's an outrageous amount, $200,000 a year for a Harvard Law professor. But they only teach 100 hours a year. So they're earning $2,000 for each teaching hour. That's a lot of money.
in, and if they're letting the kids go home early, they're earning more than that.
Well, that's true. It's only a 50 minute hour or something like that. I mean, they give 10 minutes.
Yeah.
It's true.
It's if you finish your test, you can go home.
We're 25% more than the 2,000. It's actually 2,500.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the listening audience, and certainly I understand what's going on there. We're just looking at a more practical way of allowing people to go to school. Now, somebody's going to say, well, but it's not Harvard. You know, I want to go to Harvard. Why can't I get into Harvard? Well, you have to be able to meet the criteria, because it's been set up that they get who they want there, or any major school. You know, obviously, they didn't have a problem having Carl Pearson there, and he went to Harvard.
Well, I was fortunate. I felt I was accepted by every law school that I applied to, got scholarships from them all, and I chose Harvard because I believed then, and I think even now, that it's the best law school to go to. That one doesn't really know. I mean, you just... It's a sort of prejudice. My father went there. I went there, and it's a good education. But you can create the same education elsewhere. You can't create the history. I mean, Harvard was formed in 1636 or something like that, and I can't create that. And the ivy on the walls and on the walls and that, but. You can use the same books, and you can study the same way and reach the same result and do it at very low cost. And I set up a first-year law program, and I know I achieved that. I think you can do this in college, too. You don't have to have ivy. You don't need green campuses and dormitories. You can study and learn and do it locally and do it at very low cost. And the bargain that you get is that you become very highly educated and you become economically more valuable to yourself and to the community. It's a big plus for the community.
Yeah. Well, Carl, it's time for us to take a break here. And so we're going to take a short pause and come back and continue this discussion. I also wanted to talk a little bit about contract law. I've had a few people ask if we could go into a discussion of that.
Sure.
About a month or so ago when you were on the show.
Sure.
And if you remember, I brought that up. So we'll go into that in a few minutes in our second segment. You're listening to Cabinet Footprint on BTFRadio.com. Our guest, Carl Pearson. And I will be right back, so don't go away.
HempUSA.org is now offering free shipping worldwide. To get these fine products to you in the least amount of time so you can enjoy what the hemp seeds and oil can do for you. HempUSA.org has a warning that the U.S. food supplies are dangerously low, and we urge you to protect your family with hemp storable foods today. Tomorrow, eat bullet 908-7126-8 or visit USA.org. This incredible food supplies so your body can digest the food you eat and creates an alkaline environment where cancer can't grow and parasites cannot live and brings funguses, viruses, and bacterial levels down and to a halt. Try our powder seeds and oil today. Call 908-691-2608 or visit hempusa.org. If the body has the proper nutrition, it will heal itself. Ask yourself, why does our government not allow this crop to grow in the U.S.? This product is also great for pets and animals. Call 908-691-2608 or go to hempusa.org today.
The Idaho Observer, a monthly newspaper, next year addressing issues of all freedom-loving Americans, is one of the few remaining newspapers courageous enough to print the truth. Concerned about the burgeoning national debt and the Orwellian police state growing up around you? Subscribe today. $25 for 12 monthly issues. That Observer prints what you need to know to be fully informed American. At o-observer.com or call 208-255-2307.
Welcome back to Evident Footprints on BBS Radio on this 20th day, or depending on what part of the country you're in, 21st of November 2008. And our special guest, Carl Pearson, lawyer from New York City. Carl, welcome back to the show. We were discussing a variety of issues which will empower a community. Both the concept of being able to market your talents in a particular field so that you can earn a living, as well as provide a very low cost or virtually a free learning institution of higher education for a small or medium sized town, where you can actually introduce those graduating students into the workforce and really have a strong backbone on a local level. It's something that's missing so much these days. And we also talked about the possibility of discussing contract law. There are a few areas that some of the listeners wrote in about. One certainly is what has become critical in the area of real estate, where these contracts were sold to foreign banks or to other banks, unbeknownst to the people that signed the original mortgages with the lending banks, and then these contracts were given to a foreign bank. A perfect example would be in Cleveland. A few months ago, they tore down about 1,000 homes out of 2,000 that were foreclosed by Deutsche Bank, and one person had the gumption to file a lawsuit against Deutsche Bank because they didn't have the contract. And I don't know if it was actually the plaintiff himself or his attorney that realized he didn't have the contract, but that became the whole crux of his case. And as you know, I think there were three cases that were adjudicated favorably to the plaintiffs. They had never gotten a piece of the paperwork. And that's an issue because the bailout is sort of the same thing, that people are assigning all this debt to us in the form of a contract or in the form of an agreement. And if it's a law or if it's a bill, as far as I'm concerned, there's really no difference. If it's a legally binding piece of paper, why don't we have copies? Why is our signature not necessary to be burdened with that amount of debt? And so I'd like to talk about the rights of the individual that is finding him or his or herself in the midst of one of these situations where they had nothing to do with all the problems that are resulting, and yet they're expected to either give up their home or to be spending years paying back money that they didn't lose in the beginning. Any comments?
Mortgage foreclosures, you have to realize that there are two different types of foreclosures. One is called a non-judicial foreclosure. In California, Nevada, New Hampshire, other states, the lender does not go into court. They just sell your property. If you're in default and they give you notice, they put up a sign and auction off your property and take the money and throw you out of the house. In New York State and other states, there is a judicial foreclosure requirement. And there, the lender has to go into court. And in New York, it's the there's a series of procedures that have to be gone through. And if you defend yourself in a mortgage foreclosure action in New York, you can expect to have maybe a 14-month or longer period of time in which you stay in your property. So you first of all have to know whether your state is a judicial foreclosure or a non-judicial. I'd like to talk about the judicial foreclosure because you have better opportunities there to defend your property. And the thing to do is to make sure that you file a timely answer to the complaint. When you're served with a summons and complaint, you generally have 20 days to answer, and make sure that you answer. Don't let the fact that you are negotiating or trying to negotiate a modification agreement deter you from filing an answer in the case, because if you don't, the bank's lawyer will be rushing along to get a default judgment against you even while you are dealing with the bank trying to get a modification agreement. So the thing that you're raising, Don, are what are the different defenses that a homeowner might have in a mortgage foreclosure action that are legitimate, that can hold up the mortgage foreclosure for a period of time to allow a modification agreement to be worked out, hopefully. That's what I think you're driving at, is what different defenses can a homeowner raise that are based on contract or breaches of contract or whatever.
And my understanding is of these 2,000 cases is that it was just paper that was given to someone else for whatever reason. They saw a way to make money, and probably their intention all along was just to foreclose on these properties so they could start anew with a potential buyer from square one, in other words. And whatever money they had was icing on the cake at that point.
If a lender lends money at a rate of interest that becomes obvious where you can't pay off the loan, the lender then is lending the money knowing and expecting a default, and that the lender will take over the property. There may be lender's liability there because they suck people into entering into a contract with superior knowledge. The bank knows that you won't be able to meet the expense. They know how much money you earn. They know when the higher rate of interest is going to kick in. They can predict that you're going to go in default, and the bank will then get back the property. And you can allege in your answer that the bank intended to put you in default and to take over your property and never told you that, defrauded you basically out of your property by the way they entered into this contract. In some cases it will work, and in other cases the judge may say, oh, I don't think so, and throw that defense out. There's no uniformity in law. You would hope that there is, but with some judges, some courts, things work, and in other courts, other judges, it doesn't work. But you try to put your best issues forward. And if the bank possibly doesn't own the note or the mortgage and has sold it to someone else, allege in your answer that upon information and belief, I don't think that the plaintiff has the note or the mortgage. I think upon information and belief, they've sold it into a marketplace, and therefore I would be at risk if they foreclosed on the property and the real owner of the mortgage and note sued me. I'd have to pay twice. So that case that you're talking about, three different decisions, held that it is a defense to a mortgage foreclosure action if the plaintiff doesn't have the note and mortgage.
Yes. Now, there are other types of contracts that fall into the same category. I have a real problem with this issue because of what's happening in the stock market, and I don't play the market, okay? But I'm speaking on behalf of all those people that really think that they're investing into an honest system when they invest in a particular type of stock. Whether it's the blue chips or maybe some technological stock, a newcomer, when they can pull off the sort of deals that they pull off, or when they can with impunity, they can go and put this money in offshore accounts or into offshore projects and not tell the people that have invested in that stock that they have all of a sudden risked and possibly even violated some law in their greed to make more profit for themselves, that the owner of that particular stock, that individual investor, should have some recourse against that being done. Now, they could say, well, it's up to the company to invest the money however they choose. But if they're violating laws and nothing is being done about it, shouldn't somebody be held accountable for that? And civilly and criminally.
Here are some of the problems that you're raising.
Yes.
We generally in the United States have a right of people who are injured to bring a lawsuit to obtain justice.
Yes.
And that sounds good. The problem is that the litigation has become so filled with technicalities and so many requirements, so many hours of work and conferences and discovery and depositions and trials and transcripts and all of this, all of the hours that you spend in litigation, the lawyers are going to ask for somewhere between $150 and maybe $700 or $800 an hour. It ranges around that between, say, $150 and $800 an hour. So in a lawsuit, it often takes 100, 200, 500 hours or more. So we're talking about trying to get justice for a person that's out $2,000 or $3,000, and he has to lay out for legal fees $50,000, $100,000, $200,000, which they don't have, and which doesn't make sense to lay out. So the people, the bad guys that are stealing money, know that the individuals who are hurt, as a practical matter, can't go into court to do anything about it. So another thing they did was make sure that they immunized the government workers or agencies who might otherwise go to bat for the small guy. They co-opted these organizations politically and made them immune and made them unable to do anything to help people, so that the SEC, for example, doesn't go after these wrongdoers. The ones who have perverted the stock market, have ruined the economy, the SEC sat by and watched them do it and licensed them to do it. They allowed them to do it and did nothing about it. And you and I don't have the money to go in and fight. So I have a remedy for that. The remedy that I have is part of my package for Hopeless Indiana, and that is to have Hopeless appoint me, as they did, as their town attorney general. And that means that at government expense, I can go in and start taking on some of these problems that are hurting the residents of Hopeless. And this means that the residents of Hopeless don't have to put up the money they don't have in order to seek justice that they're entitled to. The government enforces the duties of residents of Hopeless. Why don't they enforce the rights of the residents of Hopeless? And that's the job of the town attorney general, to enforce the rights of people, of townspeople, at government expense. And that doesn't mean every right that's being violated, but when you have a group of people who are injured by the same practice, that's the appropriate time for the attorney general for the town to come in and do something about it and try to save money, try to protect the economy for the town and do so at government expense. It's a legitimate government expense, and the town should do it, and the town can do it if they have a sophisticated lawyer, not somebody that knows zoning, and that in itself is sophistication, but in a different area. You need a lawyer that's familiar with trademarks and patents and copyrights and antitrust and EEOC and all of these federal statutes and litigation in the higher courts. You need that. You need to protect the people of the town by having a sophisticated lawyer work for the townspeople and for the benefit of the town. And that's what I'm offering throughout the nation to any town or village. I will help them set up a town attorney general to do that. And the added advantage is that there are many companies that are injuring the town and its people. The town attorney general would sue those companies, recover money, and that would be sufficient to give free health care for the residents of the town.
Now, that's outside of Barack Obama's promise, right?
Oh, they can't do anything like this. There's no way that the federal government can revitalize a town like a town can revitalize itself. You don't need the federal government to come in and redo a town. They're not going to do it. The federal government takes money out of the town. They don't really put money into it. But you can have the town itself rejuvenating itself financially, making it prosperous, whereas the federal government can't. A single town and many towns and all towns individually can do this for themselves, and they should, but they don't know anything about it. They never heard of it.
Encapsulating or let's say painting a broad brush ring around the different types of contracts that there are. When someone enters another into some liability without that person's knowledge, whether it's a mortgage company or a bank or in a sense, even the government, when the government is secretly doing something that causes us to be liable for something that we're unaware of, and we've not been given a copy of the liability and the so-called contract or the so-called agreement, what recourse do we have? Now, we can say, well, you know, we're not going to get anything done, you know, because this is the federal government. I have a hard time accepting that. if you understand my meaning, it's as though I'm being told, well, I understand that there's a cause there, but they're not going to do anything, so therefore don't try it, or just allow people to stomp all over you. Because where do you draw the line? If the federal government's allowed to do it, then they're going to allow the states to do it, and the states are going to allow the counties to do it, and then counties are going to allow the local communities to do it, and then the private citizens, and then you have total chaos. And it's pretty chaotic right now the way it is, you have to admit. So I'm thinking in a general sense, anyone that enters on behalf of another, enters that person into some third-party contractual agreement, what rights does the individual who's being harmed have?
I have to have something more specific than that. That doesn't give me enough to go on. I really want to hear something very specific, and I can then give you a better insight. But you don't give me enough legal handles to work with here. I can't figure out exactly what the problem is. Give me a specific example here.
Yeah, I'm trying to present it in a general way because I've gotten so many different types of questions. Let me think of some that I got. Okay, let's say, for example, that I'm letting a friend of mine use my boat. Okay, and my friend decides that he's finished using the boat, and he takes the boat out of the water, whether that's on a river or a lake or the ocean. He takes it away from the dock where he was storing it, and he moves it onto his property and decides that he can't keep it there for one reason or another. Either he doesn't have the room for it, or he might be renting where he lives, and and the people that are renting his place won't allow him to keep that boat there, that it's an eyesore. Or it's creating clutter or something like that. So he decides he's going to move it somewhere else. Now, it's not his boat, and he's borrowed the boat, but he's entered into, a storage agreement with someone, where now someone else is going to store this, and the bill is going to be assessed to the person who owns the boat.
Is all this done with the knowledge and permission of the owner of the boat?
No. And this could be a car, or it could be a truck, or it could even be a piece of property, if you get my meaning. It could be a motor home or a mobile home or, you know, some valuable piece of property that is movable.
And now the one that's parking it asserts a lien, a mechanic's lien or a material lien.
Yes.
And you can't get the boat back until you pay for the storage.
Yes. To me, it sounds it smacks of like there's a plot to extort money out of the individual, if you get my meaning.
Well, if let's put it this way, if you analyze it like this, if you want to play real hardball, you could claim that the boat was stolen. And a person in possession of stolen property has no right to retain it and doesn't have the right to charge fees for holding it. That's hardball.
Yeah.
If you want to say that, if you want to admit that your friend took it with your knowledge and put it on the property with your knowledge, and that you are aware of the bail, or you're aware of the agreement, and you are now consenting to it because you've allowed it to happen, and they're using the property of the yacht, the boatyard, why shouldn't you have to pay for it?
Well, I'm not necessarily saying it's the boatyard. In other words, I'm saying it's a third party. I'm addressing the email that I got, but if the party that lent the boat to the friend expected the boat to either remain at all times under the care of the person who they lent it to, and he has now decided to assign that care, that agreement, to another person. Let's say it's just a verbal agreement, but in a place where, you know, verbal agreements are legal. Then now he's assigned that care of the boat to another person for whatever reason. Maybe he just didn't want to take care of it anymore, so he decided.
How about assigning it to the person, the third party, for the third party's personal use? And now the third party not only is using it, but is trying to receive money for storage. That's really akin to stealing, and there would be there would be no right to withhold the boat because there never was an agreement to pay money for storage.
Yes.
And in fact, the claim is that you were improperly using my boat, and I want you to pay me for the use. Forget storage. I want you to pay me for the use and the wear and tear and the unlawful retention of my property knowingly.
Mm-hmm.
So you could turn that one around.
Yes. Now, that would be the same if it was a motor home, for example, or a mobile home, something that can be moved, let's say.
Yeah, I just worry about what the real agreement is. If you tell me what the real arrangement is, it's easier to analyze it. But if you skip over what the agreements were along the way, I don't know how to analyze it. I have to know really what each agreement was and what authority they had to enter into it, implied or otherwise. If the owner knows that someone is taking the boat and is going, or the motorhome, and is going to be using it and handing it over for storage to somebody, you know, I don't see why the owner wouldn't have to pay for this storage. But if the boat is stolen, then you can get the property back because you're not allowed to withhold stolen property.
Yes.
But if it isn't stolen, then I have to worry more about what authority there was and whether someone has notice and what the purpose of a contract was. Was it for storage or for use or for both and so on? So
yeah.
That's why I need specifics to try to consider the different aspects to whatever the issue is.
Yeah, there was a lady in Arkansas a couple of months ago that had written in about this specific issue in relationship to a motor, or I should say a mobile home, that was parked, you know, on a property, was willingly allowed to be parked there on the property for an indefinite amount of time. There was no deadline as to when that had to be moved.
Were they paying monthly, or was this one that they just said, go ahead, you can park it there?
Yeah, they were just offered a gratuitous space.
Right, gratuitous. Well, yeah. At the point where the owner of the land says, look, I've been doing this now for you for 6 months, but please take it off my property, I think that at that time or within a few days later, rent could properly be charged because of the failure to remove the goods. Rent, you know, for storage.
Yeah.
Probably
well,
could be charged,
yeah.
Randomly.
In this case, that hadn't occurred, but then it went to another party, and that party was then demanding money, you see. So the person had it moved without the consent or the knowledge of the other person.
We have trillions of different relationships, and the law tries to set up general rules that you can think through and really try to arrive at a common understanding of society of what should be the result. And the judges try to enforce mm-hmm. those rules and come up with a predictable result. But too often, judges are not predictable, and the results are not predictable, and therefore, law does break down to some extent. It seems unfair that we uh-huh. can't have predictability, but it's often very difficult, very difficult.
Yeah, what I'm getting at is we enter an agreement between two friends, and then all of a sudden it becomes an agreement between two people who don't even know each other, and the one is attempting to financially gain from the other. Now, it may feel justified for whatever person, but who would be liable for that?
Supposing the agreement, the written agreement says this shall not be assignable without the express prior written consent of the other party.
Well, I don't know what the agreement said,
if it said that, then the one that takes the assignment takes it subject to those words.
Yes.
And therefore, there's no assignment because it wasn't consented to.
Yes,
so
exactly.
Agreements depend upon what they say. You have to read an agreement. If it's verbal,
yes.
That's another story because sometimes you don't have enough. You have to...
Well, simply put, A and parties A and B have an agreement, verbal agreement. All of a sudden, B enters into a private agreement with C, unbeknownst to A.
What's the verbal agreement? That I give you carte blanche to do anything you want with this property? Or what is the verbal agreement?
The verbal agreement is you can leave your mobile home here.
Okay.
On my lot here.
Okay, now that doesn't mean that they can use it. It's really parking. The purpose was to park.
Yeah.
And now the one that owns the lot where the property is parked is now making use of the vehicle or what?
No, has determined that he's going to give the put the vehicle in the possession of a third party, unbeknownst to the first party, the owner of the mobile home.
That seems to be a wrongful use of the property, and they could be held liable for wear and tear, use of the property, reasonable rental, more than likely. That's what it sounds like. But that means that in order to get that, you have to sue. And if you're suing for $50 or $100 and it costs you $3,000 in legal fees, it's not worth it.
Yeah. Well, the reason I'm using this as an example now, and that's one, you know, I get these questions from time to time from people, especially after you've been on the show, ask Carl this, ask Carl that. And with our limited time, you know, we try to ask those questions or discuss these issues. because in a sense we've had the same thing done to the whole country with these bailouts. Someone has failed at their business, and someone else arbitrarily decides that someone else has to pay to make their business all of a sudden do a bit better, without any accountability for why they failed or how they intend to use the money that the rest of us have been penalized because of their competence?
I think you have to step back. We have institutions in the United States that are supposed to stop improper growth, unreasonable growth.
Yes.
That is, if a company becomes monopolistic,
yes,
we shouldn't allow them to grow any further. If they or if two companies want to combine and they're heading towards a monopoly and they're creating bigness, which if fails, we're going to allow the federal government to pick up the cost, we should have stopped those companies from growing. We should have said, no, we're not going to allow you to merge. Why did we allow these companies to merge? Why did J.P. Morgan and Chase Manhattan Bank and Chemical Bank and Morgan Trust Company, all of these different companies have been gathering together? Why? Why are we allowing financial institutions to get larger and larger? Even after the crisis, we allowed acquisitions by what the Bank of America acquired, one of those, was it, I forget which one. But our institutions are failing us, meaning our government is failing us, because they should not have allowed these companies to get to the point where if they failed, it's going to cost the public money. We should have stopped them dead in their tracks and allowed others to prosper, but we didn't, because there was payoffs and there were political favors and politicians that were willing to look the other way, and they allowed and continue to allow bigness to be there instead of trying to stop it, and that's where the evil is.
Well, yes, I agree with that. If I were to look at what I know is really happening, they're trying to cover their tracks because of gross corruption, gross breach of law that has been committed by and fraud.
They got their money out of it already. They took their money out of it.
Yes.
And now they want the government to put back and give them the money that they took out of it.
Yes, exactly.
It's not right. It's not fair. What about giving the public something such as stopping the late fees, the outrageous, usurious late fees and interest charges, default interest charges, or higher rates of interest when you are one day late? This is what they ought to do as the penalty, is to give the public something back.
Or
but
higher rate
don't.
Of
they,
interest.
They don't give a thing back to the public. We only give the rich more money. It's not right. We need to give something to the people that put up the money, not the people that steal the money.
Yes. Well, in a sense, this is the same thing, because I did not get to look at this agreement that binds me to have to pay that money, or you, or any of us. Even those that were given the agreement didn't do it. They did it under threat, under duress, under threat of martial law. It seems to me, isn't that blackmail?
When you talk about an agreement, I have to say that I don't see the agreement. You're saying that when the government tells you that every family is going to pay so much money as a result of this, that's not an agreement. This is a tax system that we have the government wasting our money, and we have to pay the taxes. There's no agreement in there. This is just this is how government works, that we get taxed and the money's stolen by people. This is what goes on all the time. Government is in the business of transferring the money from the workers to the people that don't deserve it.
That's
basically the rich.
Yeah, I'm speaking in a very basic general term. When I say agreement, it's between the government and whatever criminal institution they're going to feed the money to.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I mean, but that's what they do. They take our money by threat of putting us in jail, and then they enter into sweetheart deals with their favorite people that don't need the money, and they turn over billions of dollars to the rich who don't need it. They don't need it. We do. And they take it from us, the people who need it. It's crazy. And people,
yeah.
And we can do something about that, but only at the local level. We can set up a system that can be, it can screen us, it can protect us, in a sense, from this unfortunate mess. But we can prosper in spite of it. And that's what we have to do at the local level.
Yeah, well, I still have this issue. I guess I can't get it out of my system, if you understand my meaning. I don't mean to be obstinate about it. And I'm sure anyone... Here's the thing. Most people don't have a radio show where they can vent and talk about this. I happen to have one, and I happen to know specifically what they're doing with the money behind the scenes. The bank you were thinking of, by the way, that suddenly was rescued by Bank of America was Bank of New York Mellon. In fact, I had predicted 4 days before that happened, I predicted they were going to be the next bank to go under. And they were bought out for $3 billion.
And it's not right that bigness, once again, was resulted. It shouldn't be that way. We should not have an increase in size. It only leads to more of this.
And to me, yes, I'm in agreement with you. This is total insanity that they expect us to pay for their corruption. It's not a question of their failure. This is corruption. This is nothing but an excuse, a piss poor excuse for corruption.
But isn't politics corrupt?
Well, now are the banks political machines though? Are the banks political machines? If I put my money in a bank, does that mean I'm practicing politics? Am I voting?
If you give your money to government, you're going to find that politics is going to steal your money. That's the way it works.
Well, government, but if I'm putting it in the bank.
I don't think that you would. That it's hard to envision that you have a legal claim. This is a political issue, probably, but I don't want to forego thinking about this more as to whether there could be a claim. For example, maybe this is somebody, I think, brought a lawsuit claiming that there was an improper delegation of legislative power to the treasurer, who was given the authority to just hand out this money without any standards. Now that would be a lawsuit. That's justiciable.
Yes.
So that along your idea that there must be some contractual right, there's really a right to argue that this transaction is illegal because it delegated congressional or legislative authority to an official of government that really shouldn't have that much power. That's a legitimate lawsuit, and I think it's been brought.
Yes, if I could be more explicit about my contempt for what's going on. It's one thing if, and I understand what you're saying, if you say, well, this is a political issue, if they pass a bill and they assign this cost to people, it's going to be a tax issue. We're being taxed to pay for crimes that have been committed. There have been innumerable crimes committed using computer screens, money laundering during a time of war, which is an act of treason, and we are being billed for the cost of that?
My concern, actually
bailing these people out from their criminal action, from their treason?
My concern is that I always look to see a solution. And when I hear things that are political, the problem that I have with that is that I don't know what more you can do except run for the presidency yourself. Yeah, I mean, this is what the problem is, that when they steal money politically, and there's not much you can do about it except join the thieves, become a senator, become a congressman, become a thief, and join them, and then see what you're going to do once you're in that environment where everyone takes money. They need the money to get reelected, so they wind up not doing what they promised that they were going to do. So I think that you can argue that in some cases there is a breach of law, there's a violation of law, and then it becomes a justiciable issue you can bring into court. But many of the things that they do to allocate money is just a political issue. Just don't vote for that guy next time. It's not a good result. It's not fair. It's outrageous, in fact, and they've been relying on it for years to steal money. But I say let's get away from worrying about that and let's see what we can do to to bring prosperity to hopeless, to all the small towns in the country. We can bring prosperity even though there is this total criminality and illegality and theft, the grand theft that's going on at the federal level.
Well, at least you agree with me on that
point. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's been that way for a long time.
Yeah.
And it's forcing us into doing something locally because we can't expect any help, and we're not going to get it. We can have all the elections every 4 years and have a popular person be elected, but don't think that that's going to bring a free college to hopeless. I can bring a free college. A person who lives in hopeless can bring a free college to hopeless, but they have to want to change. They have to step forward, identify themselves, and say, I want change in hopeless, because we can show them how to do it.
Now, do you advise they have a contract?
Well, you don't really need a contract.
I'm just joking.
You need the political will of the leaders of the town to make the town prosperous.
Yeah, I'm being
so simple.
A bit facetious.
I mean, it's really just outrageously simple to bring prosperity to a town. And why isn't everyone in the country looking to do that?
Yeah. We have this discussion every night in one sense or another, and it boils down and it's true when you say on the local level, it brings it down to the individual level, doesn't it?
It's the level where you can knock on the door of everyone who lives in town and get them to understand what they need to do, and they'll be willing to do it. They just have to find out what to do. We don't have systems set up to advise them. We really have to step, we have to take charge and go in there and knock on doors and say, look, this is what we have for you. Oh, gee, I didn't know it. I didn't hear. Nobody told me about it. Gee, it sounds great. I'd love to do it. And yet none of that is newsworthy, right? Bringing prosperity to a town is not newsworthy.
Yeah, isn't that a shame?
Yeah. Instead, misery is newsworthy. You got to lead off with the blood. That's the newspaper people say that you've got to lead off, or the television people say you've got to lead off with a bloody story first. That attracts the interest of the viewers. Show them some blood.
Yeah, if they're seeing it, they know it's not their own.
Don't
so
tell them how they can be
prosperous
and how they can cure the problems of their mortgages and all that. Don't let them know anything useful, because they'll never come back to the station. They're not looking for that. Where are they? Maybe they are looking for it.
Yeah. Well, I wonder how far back contract law actually goes. Did they teach you that in law school contract?
Yeah, you have different forms of in the common law. They had a keeper of the king's conscience, and he became the chancellor of equity, so that matters that were equitable and in the discretion of the people who decided disputes, it would go to the keeper of the king's conscience, and he would render equity. But to get equity, you must do equity. You must be equitable in trying to seek an equitable adjustment. Then there were legal then there was a court of law where you had to have your complaint written out exactly the way a form required you to do it. And if you were a little bit off, they rejected your complaint out of just being legalistically improper. They had real forms that you had to apply to, and often you got shafted. You couldn't get your case because you didn't have the right form. So if you got shafted that way, you could go into a court of equity and maybe seek justice there from the Chancellor of Equity. But that, over the years, the English system has been transported to America, and we have the same rules, basically, a lot of the same doctrines. There's a carryover, a tremendous carryover of English law into American law, and the rules of contracts are basically not statutory, they're common law. The rules of negligence and that, they're not statutory. The government doesn't pass statutes relating to that. It's common law. They've evolved over the years.
Mm-hmm. It seems, in a way, like the law has taken on this characteristic that despite what it once was, it has become a pretty direct path to the desired outcome of those that administrate it. In other words, I think there was a time, even when I was younger, where there were outcomes in court cases that favored plaintiffs as well as they did defendants. And it seemed like there was a point where the truth in most cases was gotten to. And so either someone won their case as a plaintiff because they were able to bring the truth out, or the defendant was exonerated because the truth came out. Now, of course, that's both in criminal and civil cases. However, it seems to be more in favor of the defendant now in a criminal case.
No, no, absolutely not. The criminal gets shafted in today's court system. There are so many different rules and advantages that the prosecutor has that it forces 97% of the accused felony criminals to plead guilty, even though most of them are probably not guilty. It is so outrageous the way the criminal procedure works, where you have a prosecutor that works in secret for years and serves subpoenas on everyone and threatens to put them in jail unless they tell the prosecutor what he wants to hear. So they tell him what he wants to hear, and that way the prosecutor gives them immunity. They buy witnesses left and right, and they threaten people with obstruction of justice if they try to do anything.
Well, you're talking about a prosecution where they're intentionally bringing, where they're setting someone up.
Any prosecutor. And the prosecutors do this in order to gain convictions. They have notches in their belt, mm-hmm. and they want to become judges and run for office, and they think the best way of doing it is to get convictions. And they get them improperly in many cases, and we need a town attorney general to start suing prosecutors to try mm-hmm. to force them into obeying the law.
Well, I know of too many cases where the victims who are being represented by those prosecutors are often given the shaft.
That's true, because in many cases an alleged criminal event is just not newsworthy enough for the prosecutor, so he looks for someone to shaft to gain publicity rather than to just get justice for the victim. That's not inconsistent. It's when a prosecutor goes after somebody, they have the tools to convict them whether they're guilty or not. So those are two different issues. Number one, does the prosecutor seek justice for everyone that's a victim? And the answer is no. That's your problem. That's fine. When the prosecutor selects somebody to justice, is the prosecutor fair? Does he abuse the process? Oh, absolutely, and he's not fair. Those are consistent ideas here.
Yeah. I agree with you there, but I'm saying, I guess when I say that I've seen the defendant treated more favorably, many, you know, these little loopholes that are there when there's a preponderance of evidence that the person committed crime.
The defendant in your situation is treated more fairly. The defendant that goes to trial, you see, your defendant is one that is not going to trial. They let him off. So in that case, when a person is let off, I agree, they treat him more favorably. But when a defendant is now going to trial, he gets shafted. He really gets shafted. Some of the defendants that go to trial are really guilty, and you're thankful that they get shafted and convicted. But many of the people are not guilty, and the trial, a legitimate trial, would not find them guilty. Because guilt, as I understand it and believe it, is beyond a reasonable doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter, in my eyes, whether someone is guilty or not, actually. That's something that only God knows, and the defendant. Maybe the defendant doesn't even know. But the way our system is set up to determine that is beyond a reasonable doubt. And most of the criminal cases, if they were tried fairly and pre-tried fairly, you would not have convictions. You would have maybe half the people convicted and maybe half not. And that's the way it should be. We should have enough margin for error so that no innocent person gets convicted. And we have to let a lot of the guilty people off to accomplish that. And we need that to protect you and me and the listening audience.
Mm-hmm. Well, it just brings up so many other issues, too. We get into this aspect of political, politics in general, and I'm not speaking so much about promises, but if we were to look at the acts committed by those in power, and where our Constitution isn't followed, I mean, where's the law? Is it that there's no law, or the law is just going to be in some place hiding under a rock, and if we're happy in it, or fortunate
things.
Enough to find it, that maybe we'll succeed?
Two things, that if the law wasn't followed and the statute was somehow declared effective, you might be able to have it declared invalid because of the failure to follow the law. But I think basically the kind of things that you're talking about are impeachable offenses. And
yes.
You have a bunch of gangsters and people that don't abide by the law, and you're not going to have them accusing each other of misconduct because they all conduct misconduct. They all are guilty of it, so they're not going to rush around impeaching each other. Don't expect that. You need a broad reform, and I think that starting at the local level, we can do a better job than trying to reform at the top. It's too hard, too ingrained, and it takes every 4 years or every 2 years. Forget about it. Let's bring prosperity to hopeless and hundreds of other communities in America. Anyone that wants prosperity can get it. You only have to listen to Don's show. And then contact Don, and Don and I, can come in and help you bring prosperity to your town. That's what we can do.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm playing the devil's advocate here and asking those questions in that fashion so that we can discuss this, because there's a lot of question, there's a lot of chatter right now, especially on the Internet talk shows, where people are saying, what can we do about this? You know, this is really getting out of hand, everything that's going on. And, of course, you're offering a solution. I'm hearing these other questions being asked, and they really make a lot of sense. It's sort of like going up to the band of bank robbers that have found their little nook in the mountains where they've got their horses tied up to some sagebrush. They've got a campfire going. They're deciding what bank they're going to rob next, and you happen upon them and try to reason with them, asking them to return the money to the bank, you know.
Right. It's not going to happen. You know, what about the pirates? There's a lot of talk about pirates. We've taken politicians and their thievery, and we've now activated a lot of pirates to do the same thing privately. That's interesting. We've got pirates stealing hundreds of millions of dollars worth of ships. Why don't we just use the Predator? There's a device called a Predator that's unmanned, and it can follow ships around, and I believe that some models have an ability to drop a bomb, if I'm not mistaken. So we could actually zero in on these. We have satellites in the sky. I mean, we have enough technology to be able to stop this and to blow the pirates out of the water before they even board the ships that they're going to steal.
Well, it's already been determined, if I'm not mistaken, Carl, that the pirates that did this were all pretty young boys outfitted by the Bush Clinton cabal.
No.
Oh
no,
yeah.
My God.
And they're trying to get back at the Saudis over this.
Oh,
you see,
Jesus.
It's if you read between the lines, it makes a lot of sense. It wouldn't be the first time something like this went on.
So we have sort of a stand down of our military system because the people don't want these pirates stopped.
Exactly. This is a criminal move designed to have a geopolitical influence on a foreign country.
My God. Nothing is ever what it seems to be. You know, that's really the rule. You can never trust any news because it's bound to be inaccurate.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Now, I tell you, I had this discussion, you know, earlier this evening with someone with whom I agree. I mean, if I intuit what's going on and connect the dots together, it has everything to do even with some of the picks that Obama made in his cabinet. Particularly the person there's a likely connection with who he picked for Attorney General in this event, this piracy event.
Oh, my God.
Because you can attach Mark Rich to that, okay? And Mark Rich was a fugitive that was under indictment by Rudy Giuliani. Mark Rich was running, and at the end of Clinton's last day of his presidency, he pardoned Mark Rich. Mark Rich's real name is Hans Brandt, and he worked for Dresser Industries, by the way. That was one of the companies he worked with, and he was an arms dealer. Now, who else do we know who worked for Dresser Industries? Bush family. That's how they ended up going to Texas, was courtesy Dresser Industries. It's a small world, you see. and so Mark Rich was working for the Clintons during the Clinton presidency. He was a money launderer. He was receiving billions of dollars of stolen money. And a lot of this was going on too during the Reagan presidency, and when they sent Mark Rich to Europe, William Sessions ordered Leo Wanta to arrest him as a Treasury agent and as a Secret Service agent. Of course, Wanta was set up and arrested by the Swiss police at that time, and Rich was allowed to escape. Sometime later, 4 years later, we had the first multi-trillion-dollar missing money reported by the Pentagon. And this occurred every year, anywhere from $1.9 to $2.3 trillion missing, even though they had a budget around that time of somewhere between $380 and $600 billion. Somehow they misplaced these extra trillion. Where did that money come from? And right at the same time Dov Zakheim leaves the Pentagon, Mark Rich, shortly before that, disappears. it's very interesting, and it ties his attorney, by the way, was Eric Holder, the guy who's nominated for attorney general. International money launderer, international drug dealer, an arms dealer. That's who he was defending. So it gets pretty interesting when you do the research behind the scenes to see who these people really are tied with. These were, I'm told they were like from 16 to 18 year old kids. These
that
pirates.
That would be the life expectancy on the island there. Where is it, Somalia, that they come from, or where was it?
I think they were from Somalia, yes.
Yeah.
But who knows? You know, they say that. I tend to think that the first terrorists that we had at the Munich Games in 1972,
yeah,
we were told were from the Palestinian Liberation Army, yeah, they were probably Israeli Mossad agents.
Things are never what they seem to be, right?
Yes.
You just have to expect that there's a difference. But as far as I'm concerned, the focus should be on the towns and villages, and that we can actually do something for them, whereas we can't do a goddamn thing except be miserable about the federal things that are going on. But And the adverse impact that it has on everyone. But we can do something locally, and I think we ought to let people know about that, let them contact us, and we can help their town become prosperous. My God, doesn't anyone want that?
Well, I know a lot of people say they do. So, yeah, I encourage people also to go to your many websites. I know that when you're on one site, you have links to some of the other ones. Is there any one site that gives all of your website addresses?
Well, yes, but I would rather direct them to election-issues-us.com. Election-issues-us.com. If you can't find that, go to lawmall.com, and the second link on the left-hand side will give you a page where you'll find that. So lawmall.com is my sort of a headquarters for 100 websites, broken down by subject matter, so it's easy to find them. But the one that has my free college and the selling of tasks, a task marketplace, a town attorney general, all of that is on election-issues-us.com.
Okay.
And there's a lot of things that can be done for a small town just to really make it prosperous and to bring back market values for the real estate, to bring mortgages up to date, to give free health care. I mean, good God, everything is here. It's a complete package to make over a town financially and to make over the residents of the town. Those that need help can get it. It's all here.
Now, one question I got via an email, by the way, someone was asking if you can use the regular sources for acquiring books, let's say for a school library. Is that feasible, and or is the school allowed to accept private contributions, let's say like someone's book collection, or if they want to unload some books
well,
that they...
This is really a tax question, I believe, not put that way, but I think that the individual is saying, can he make it a charitable donation of books to this tuition-free college? And the answer is that we're not set up yet as, and we don't even need to be, a tax-exempt organization because it's non-profit anyway, so there's no profit here. So it doesn't really matter. It doesn't have to be tax-exempt. But when it is tax-exempt, we could have donations, but the problem with any donation is that it's forcing an overhead on us, and we don't want the overhead. I don't want to build a library because somebody wants to make a donation, no matter how charitable they feel. I don't know that it fits into the curriculum that we have, and I don't want to just have to rent a room to and put in a librarian and desks and tables. I think that we can do without a library. We can do with a study area, but I don't think that we want to have a library. We have books that students need for their course. We have terminals where they can look up things on internet. I don't think that we have to go through the expense of a library.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, just a question. That was one that had come through. Or, you know, I suppose we'll get questions about computers or, you know, printers and things like that that probably would serve some use.
Every student has to have his own portable. I mean, there's no reason for the school to be stuck with that expense. The students are going to need a computer in life, and they can use it in this school.
Okay.
Broadband.
Very good.
We'll have broadband, so that they will have they won't need to have a separate account. We'll have broadband that everyone can use, and in fact, the whole town really needs broadband. Hopeless, Indiana should have broadband for free for everyone. That's an objective of remaking the town.
Yeah, I remember when they were first telling us about the internet, and I remember hearing Al Gore say it was going to be free.
Do you know that Korea has broadband that's about 100 times faster than the average broadband in the United States? South Korea.
I heard some countries have fast broadband. I didn't know it was 100 times faster.
Something like that. Maybe it's 50, but it's in that area of magnitude, which is just outrageous from our standpoint that we have such slow broadband. It's all because of monopolies and licensing and government agencies and so on. It's really unfair. But maybe the town can do something about it.
Yeah. Well, it's been interesting, Carl. We're out of time.
Okay. Anytime.
I want to thank you and the people from Hopeless, Indiana, thank you for your efforts.
Well, there's a hopeless in every state, and there's many hopelesses also in every state. And let's identify them and work with them, because we have that's one big project for us and for the members of Hopeless wherever it is.
Let's not forget Washington, D.C., too.
Yeah, that is really hopeless.
Yes.
Hopeless.
All right, well,
D.C.
Thanks a lot for being on the show, Carl, and I want to wish you a very happy Thanksgiving coming up next week.
Same, and we'll talk later.
Yes, okay.
Great.
And it's time to say goodnight to our listening audience. You have been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com and our special guest, Carl Pearson. Visit his website at myclads.com, myclads.com. If you're interested in getting some tasks registered there on the site, and you can do this in your local area, and he'll assist you for life. You can be advertising your skills. You can't beat that deal. And, of course, his interest is to assist your local town, your local community in developing a foundation of not just prosperity, but a new reality and sovereignty and everything that's missing right now because of overgrown government. We've got to be able to take an interest in what's going on where we live. And I would also like to thank Don Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick on the sound, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for joining us. make sure you listen in tomorrow night. We're at the end of the week with our Friday night guest, scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, Jim Murray. And we're going to have another great show for you tomorrow. So please tune in. In the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.